Well, we're going to read from the scriptures, and as you know, we've been looking at the Psalms of David tell us the situation in which they were written. So if you can have a finger in Psalm 57, I'm sorry for not remembering to let you know before Sunday, but Psalm 57, page 509, and put your finger there. And then go back to 1 Samuel chapter 22 on page 265. We'll just read a couple of verses from 1 Samuel and then go straight to Psalm 57. So 1 Samuel 22 on page 265. David has been fleeing. This is the same section that we read last time. And he's come from Gath, after pretending madness, and we're told, David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him, and everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. A real motley crew. The scripture doesn't say that, I'm just adding that for your benefit. So he became captain over them. We're back to the Bible now. And there were about 400 men with them. And then David went from there. And we see that various things happen in between times. Saul murders the priests. We've looked at that earlier on. David saves the city of Keilah. And he then is in the wilderness. And we've looked a little bit at 1 Samuel 23. And I'm now going to jump to chapter 24. Now it happened, when Saul returned from following the Philistines, that it was told him, saying, take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel, and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. So he came to the sheepfolds by the road, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. Then the men of David said to him, this is the day which the Lord said to you, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you. And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now it happened afterwards that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And so the story continues, and there was a brief, as it turned out, reconciliation between David and Saul as a result of David sparing Saul's life. But I read chapter 24, not to go into the details of that story, but just to remind us that very often it seems that David spent his time in caves during this whole period, because we're told here in verse 1 that David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi, and it turns out that whilst he was in the wilderness, he was actually staying in the cave. And verse 3 tells us that. And he was actually living in this cave, which was obviously very large, because David was in there with all his men. And we read earlier just how many men, 400, had gathered to him in this time. So a very big complex of caves. It's a little bit like Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, isn't it? They're hiding away in caves with everyone trying to find him and no one quite being able to manage it. I'm not comparing David with Osama bin Laden too much, don't get that impression, but you can imagine the sort of thing. We find it a bit difficult in our context, don't we, to think, well, how can you not find 400 people if they're in a cave? And maybe Osama helps us to understand that little bit of the story at least. So David spending all this time in caves, Psalm 57 there, which is what we're really looking at on page 509. To the chief musician, set to Do Not Destroy, a miktam of David when he fled from Saul into the cave. Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you, and in the shadow of your wings I will make my refuge until these calamities have passed by. I will cry out to God Most High, to God who performs all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me. He reproaches the one who would swallow me up. Selah. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. My soul is among lions. I lie among the sons of men who are set on fire, whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue is a sharp sword. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have dug a pit before me. In the midst of it, they themselves have fallen. Selah. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and give praise. Awake, my glory. Awake, lute and harp. I will awaken the dawn. I will praise you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing to you among the nations. For your mercy reaches unto the heavens, and your truth unto the clouds. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth. Well, we're in Psalm 57, and David is in a cave. We're not sure exactly at what period of time that this was written. You'll know from the bit that we've read earlier, and if you were here last week, that David, it seems, spent a long time, possibly many months, maybe even longer than that, living in caves. And the fact that we have lots of different psalms from this period seems to suggest that it was a long time, but also suggests that David required a great deal of comfort and did a great deal of reflecting. You can well imagine, can't you, that if you were on the run and having to hide away and not being able to go out really very much at all, that you would have a lot of time for reflection. And it seems that that's what David was doing during this time. And a reminder, perhaps, that even in our most difficult situations, even when it seems everything is against us and there's so little that we can do, maybe here David is thinking, well, I'd love to be able to do this, and Lord, shouldn't I be doing that? Even in that situation, David was able to find some very useful ways in which to spend his time, even if it was only, in inverted commas, meditating on the goodness of God. A very useful way to spend his time. So Psalm 57, and what I think happens in Psalm 57 is very similar to the psalm that we looked at last time. It splits nicely into three, and in each of the three different sections, we read of a kind of progression in David's thoughts. In the last psalm that we looked at, the progression was of past, of presence, and future. That's not the case here. There's a different progression as David goes through, and I hope that I be able to show you that as we go. And the first section that is here for us is verses 1 to 3, which I'm calling Hope in an Impossible Situation. Hope in an Impossible Situation. So in these verses, well, let me read the verses to you first. Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you. And in the shadow of your wings I will make my refuge until these calamities have passed by. I will cry out to God Most High, to God who performs all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me. He reproaches the one who would swallow me up. Selah. God shall send forth his mercy and truth. So those are the verses. Hope in an impossible situation. I describe it as an impossible situation because David in these verses is reflecting very much on the difficulties and the problems that he faces. And frankly, no wonder. And he describes them in very graphic terms, very compelling terms, very serious terms. So in end of verse 1, for example, he talks about these calamities. These calamities, he's waiting for calamities. That's his present situation. It's a calamitous one. And he's waiting until these things have passed by. So it's an impossible situation, A, because his present circumstances are calamitous, but B, because there's nothing that he can do about them. He is waiting until these things have passed by. He's got no hope that he himself is going to be able to do anything at all about this calamitous situation that he finds himself in. There is nothing that David can do. He's stuck in the back of his cave. Maybe he's got a few people around him. Maybe they've not yet arrived. But he's stuck in this cave and he's waiting very literally for soldiers to pass him by. And I wonder, in this kind of complex of caves that no doubt he found himself in, whether or not maybe sometimes he even saw out of the mouth of the cave, literally speaking, soldiers of Saul's army literally passing by, and he's praying perhaps that they wouldn't come in and that they wouldn't find him. So it's an impossible situation. And yet we've headed it here, hope in an impossible situation. And you can see that the whole of these three verses is full of hope, isn't it? So what is David doing? Well, he's not moping. He's not moaning. He's not complaining. He's not just sitting there pouring out his heart as if, well, what a dreadful situation I'm in. Please, won't you feel sorry for me? That's not at all what David is doing, is it? What is he doing? Well, as he says in verse 2, he's crying out to God. And what is the content of his cry? Verse 1. Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me. I think it's just very helpful, isn't it, to remember that when we're praying to God for God to give us things, we're praying from a perspective of grace and of mercy. So what David is saying here is, be merciful to me. He's not saying, Lord, what have I done to deserve this? How can this be happening to me? I'm a righteous man. This is wrong. Saul's the baddie, not me. But he starts off by saying, be merciful to me. What is mercy? Well, you know very well, don't you? Mercy is when we don't get what we do deserve. When we don't get what we do deserve. So here's David, sitting in the back of a very miserable cave. I suspect it's damp. I suspect it's cold. It's certainly dark and really quite miserable and lonely. And what David is saying, Lord, don't give me what I do deserve. And it's every Christian really needs to remember that whatever situation we find ourselves in, then we need to call for mercy. And here David begins like this. Why should God be merciful to David? Well, one answer that we can reply to that is grace, that God is very gracious. But it's not the answer that David gives. Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you. I think the ESV renders it just slightly better. The ESV says, for in you my soul takes refuge. In you my soul takes refuge. I think the ESV is slightly better there because it captures the word order or the importance of those various bits of the sentence that the Hebrew scholars tell me is there in the original. Be merciful to me, for my soul trusting you could give the impression that David thinks, well, hang on, Lord, I've trusted in you, therefore I deserve mercy. Well, you can't deserve mercy. That's a kind of a contradiction in terms, isn't it? You never deserve mercy, otherwise it wouldn't be mercy. So that can't be what David's saying. What David is saying is said, be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. And what David is saying here is not, be merciful to me because of what I've done. What he's saying is, be merciful to me because of who you are, because of what you are doing. You're around me. That's what he says in the very next verse. In the shadow of your wings, here's the New King James, gets it right, I will make my refuge, or I will take refuge. And there's this idea then of the Lord protecting David and putting his wings around you. There's that little verse, isn't there, in the New Testament, that as a hen gathered his chick, so I would long to gather you. And I must admit, that verse never meant very much to me. And then I was actually looking for a photograph of something entirely different to put in the EMW magazine, but I can't remember what I was typing in to find this photograph, but I found a picture of a hen gathering her chicks. And it's a wonderful picture. It really is. If I don't like pictures in things in sermons, but if I was ever preaching on that verse, I think I'd have to include it, because we find it so difficult to perhaps visualize, or at least I did. But there's this wonderful picture then of a mother hen, a photograph. It really is real. This mother hen gathering these chicks under her wing, and they're sort of just poking out their little heads, keeping an eye on the world, but if little chicks can, looking entirely safe and secure, that mum really does have her wings around them. And that's something of what David is saying here, that God is encompassing him, God is all around him, God is protecting him in the shadow of his wings, until these calamities have passed by, we've looked at already. And then verse 2, David continues this theme, I will cry out to God Most High, to the God who performs all things for me. This is the God who does everything. How can I doubt? How can I not have hope when this is a God who's already given me everything that I need and will continue to give me everything I need in the future? He's the source of all that I have. So I can have confidence, I can have hope in him. He shall send from heaven and save me. So this again is why it's hope, because this is all future. This is what David is wanting, is hoping for. He reproaches the one who would swallow me up. And then we have this little word, Selah, which we find a little bit difficult to understand exactly what it means in the Psalms. But usually it comes at a quite an important part where we're caused to stop and reflect. And I think, again, that's what's happening here. And after we have this word, Selah, then we're told immediately, God shall send forth his mercy and truth. And I think that's what David wants us to stop and think about. God shall send forth his mercy. That's what he started with, isn't it, back in verse 1. And his truth. And truth will out. David, after all, is innocent. And Saul is guilty. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. Again, the Hebrew has something like, God shall send forth his steadfast love and his faithfulness. He has these very rich terms in the Hebrew Bible that can, they're so kind of rich that you almost need lots of different English words to kind of make sense of them. His steadfast love, that will become important later on, so you can see a link with a later part of the psalm. So here in these first three verses then, hope in an impossible situation. Things are very difficult, very dark. There's nothing David can do, but he still hopes in God. Now, the second section is from verse 4 to the middle of verse 7. From verse 4 to the middle of verse 7. Let me read these verses. My soul is among lions. I lie among the sons of men who are set on fire, whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue a sharp sword. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have dug a pit before me. In the midst of it, they themselves have fallen. Selah, stop and think. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. If the first section was hope in an impossible situation, this second section is hope in an improving situation. Hope in an improving situation. Let me first of all just explain why I've stopped in the middle of verse 7 and to see whether these links are. I do think, as I said, that Selah is often important in a time when we should stop and think. And I did wonder at first whether or not I should stop at the end of verse 6, where the Selah happens. But if you look at what comes immediately after the Selah in verse 7, my heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. And I think David is deliberately contrasting, and you can't really see it in the New King James, but you can in some other versions, back with the end of verse 3, where we stopped our first section. It was again immediately after the Selah, when David wants us to stop and think. God will send forth, the New King James says, his mercy and his truth. The ESV says, his steadfast love and his faithfulness. So that's how David stopped in the first section. God will send out his steadfast love. And at the end of the second section, David stops with, my heart is steadfast, O God. my heart is steadfast. So there's a strong link there. And what the whole of this section from verse 4 to the middle of verse 7, remember the verse numbers are not inspired, from verse 4 to the middle of verse 7 is this hope in an improving situation. So as David starts off this section at verse 4, he describes again the difficulties and the problems that he's facing. My soul is among lions. It is trusted in you, he said that in verse 1, but actually it's among lions. Now, it may be that that was literally true. There were really lions who, well, you know that, don't you, because David killed one earlier on. There were really lions in that area. Perhaps he could see lions wandering about outside his cave and hoping they didn't come in as well. Or maybe it's simply metaphorical and he's talking about Saul's soldiers in this way. Probably both. I lie among the sons of men who are set on fire. They're burning up. They're against him in this way. It's even possible that what was happening outside was that in order to find him in the wilderness, that possibly some of the shrubbery and things was being burnt up outside in order to smoke David out. That could well be what's going on. You can imagine a cave being filled with smoke, or you can imagine some dense shrubbery where maybe some men could be hiding, and the fire comes and they're driven out. Possibly that was even going on outside. Maybe again it's metaphor. It's hard to tell in poetry, isn't it? So these things are happening. Their teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue a sharp sword. Every kind of weapon, as it were, weapons that will get you really close in, like a sword. Weapons that will get you from a little bit of a distance, like a spear. Weapons that will get you from a long way away, like arrows. They're all out to get him. I suppose nowadays we might talk about maybe rifles and cannons and missiles, perhaps. That's the sort of thing that David has got in mind. Everything is against him. So what's David going to do? Well, here is a little prayer. Verse 5. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth. And David has this wonderful ability, which we've seen time after time, don't we? Of being able to, even in the most difficult situations that he finds himself in, being able to lift his eyes and see things from God's perspective. Now, if that's something that you and I can learn to do, and pray God that he would help us to do so, then we'll find that a wonderful release of our difficult and dark situations. It is possible, isn't it, to get so wrapped up in our own problems that our problems seem worse than even they are. And I'm sure if David had just spent time after time after time reflecting on all these dreadful things going on around him and that everybody was out to get him, he really would have come to the end of his tether. Maybe he'd have handed himself in or even killed himself. But he doesn't do that. He's able to see things from God's perspective and pray, therefore, that God would be lifted up above the heavens. It's again a little bit like the Lord's Prayer, that thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And here David is praying in essence for God to be God, for God's will to be done, for God's glory to be shown. There's something wrong about this situation. That's David's point. This shouldn't be. This is not right. This is not just. Lord, you're a God of justice. Show yourself in that way. Show your glory. So it's a prayer for God, but a prayer also that helps David. Verse 6 then, he comes back down to earth. They've prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. So he's really reached the end of his tether now. He's got this kind of hope, it is there, but it seems to have reached the end of his tether. But look then in the middle of verse 6. My soul is bowed down. They have dug a pit before me. Into the midst of it, they themselves have fallen. And then we get the sailor, stop and think. So here you can see, every time David's describing his own situation prior to this, it's always been in very dark and very bleak times. Everything's against him. He's in a terrible calamitous situation. He's just waiting for these things to pass by. There's nothing he can do about it. All these weapons against him. They're preparing a net to capture him like a wild animal. They've dug this pit. And suddenly, it seems, David has a realization. Suddenly this thought springs into his head. In the midst of it, they themselves have fallen. And it's possible, and I think probably likely, that what David has realized here, as he's been thinking about God's glory being exalted, and then started to reflect on his own situation, he started to remember the things that God has promised in the past, and the things that God has promised in particular to David. And he's remembered, perhaps, that David has been anointed king, that God has promised this for him. And here are these people who are outside, who have set themselves against the Lord's anointed. And they're doing all this kind of thing to try and get David, and they're bringing all this weaponry against him. They go into all this trouble to try and get him, and David, it appears, has come to this realization, well, they can't succeed. They're going to fall into their own pit. They're going to suffer the consequences of their own evil deeds, because God has promised that I will be king. And I seem to think that's what David has realized in his mind. And again, there's an important lesson for all of us here, isn't there? To remember the promises of God. I'm sure some of you have got at home, maybe some of you have got promise boxes. Maybe those of you who are a little bit older, do you know those promise boxes where you can have a little store in there of various promises of God? Or maybe you've got Spurgeon's checkbook of the Bank of Faith, and these promises. You do have to be a little bit careful when you read promises in the Bible, because some of them are promised to specific individuals who are not us. But there are many glorious, wonderful promises in the Bible that are given to all of God's people that we really can pray through, and we really can meditate on, and really can encourage us. And we realize then that no matter what happens, God really is in control. He's promised that. God really does care for us. He's promised that. God really will do what's best for us. He's promised that. That's not an obscure promise to one person in the Old Testament. That's for all of God's people, for all of the time. We can be encouraged by that. So in dark and difficult situations, remember God's promises. But David did so by remembering God himself, first of all. And thinking about God reminded him of God's promises. He didn't kind of hunt through the Bible trying to find a promise for him. And maybe that's one of the disadvantages of promise boxes. We kind of think, what's in here for me? David wasn't doing that. And he was meditating on God from verse 5. So he suddenly comes to a realization that they're going to fall into their own pit that they've dug for themselves. So then he has this selah, this time for pause and reflection. Verse 7, my heart is steadfast. O God, my heart is steadfast. And it's almost then that David has realized that God has answered his prayer from the end of verse 3. God will send out his steadfast love and his faithfulness. He's now seen that in action in the middle of verse 7. So we started off in verses 1 to 3 with hope in an impossible situation. And now we've come in verses 4 to the middle of verse 7 to hope in an improving situation. Can you see how things are looking up now for David? But this is the really important thing that I want you to notice. Nothing has changed. You must get that. Nothing has changed at all. Nothing. The men are still outside. Maybe the lions are still outside. Maybe the fire and all those other bits and pieces are all outside as well. Nothing has changed. But David has changed. Do you remember right in the very first sermon in the series on James, I talked about suffering and why God brings suffering. And the main point from that whole sermon from James chapter 1 verses 1 to 12 was that things might not get better, but we will get better. That is the Christian's hope. And that is exactly what's happened to David. Things haven't got better at this point, but David has now become a better person. David is now more able to deal with the problems that he's facing. David is now somebody who trusts even more in God than he did before. David's faith has improved and has grown. And I need, therefore, to read James chapter 1 verse 2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, but let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. This is David's testimony to the truths of these verses. And we'll find as we just get to the end verses in just a moment or two, that David really is counting it all joy as he falls into these trials. He really is learning patience. He really is becoming mature and complete and being prepared to do this wonderful work that is ahead of him, because David, as you know, is the one that God has chosen to be the greatest king, human king, who ever lived. And Jews still consider him as that even to this day. He had a glorious kingdom. And here's all part of his preparation for it, this suffering, you see. So hope in an impossible situation, hope in an improving situation, even though nothing's changed. And then we're in the final third, from the middle of verse 7 to the end of the psalm. I will sing and give praise. Awake, my glory. Awake, lute and harp. I will awaken the dawn. I will praise you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing to you among the nations, for your mercy reaches unto the heavens and your truth unto the clouds. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth. So now David is really going for it, isn't it? He was hoping in an impossible situation, hoping in an improving situation, if you'll excuse the long word, hope in an impregnable situation. Impregnable means secure. Nothing can get at him. And he's absolutely safe. And that's what he feels. That he understands. Of course, it was always true. But he's gone from impossible to improving to impregnable with nothing changing. That's the important thing. And what does David say in these last few verses? Well, end of verse 7. I will sing and give praise. You see, God has answered his prayer. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. But he knows that God has answered his prayer. Why? Because God answered his prayer before he prayed it. God answered his prayer weeks and months, possibly years ago. Because God's promises are as good as kept, you see. God's promises are as if they're already in action. So he's able to praise God because he can take on in faith, as it were, the things that he knows will happen in the future. That's what David is talking about here. I will sing and give praise. And then verse 8, awake my glory, awake lute and harp. And you can see him, can't you? He suddenly came to himself there, didn't he, in the verse 6, this realization that these enemies had fallen into the pit they've dug for themselves. So he's saying to himself, look, get up and stop this sitting around. Praise God. He's almost preaching to himself. And he's going to get his lute and harp out. Goodness knows what the soldiers of Saul would have made of this music coming out of the cave had they heard it. But David doesn't care about that. He just wants to praise God. And I'll awaken the dawn. And, you can sort of visualize himself here playing as perhaps part of the dawn chorus. So maybe Saul's soldiers, he thinks, are still asleep, you see, as they're trying to chase him. And all the birds are singing there at, I suppose it depends on the time of the year, but maybe 3 or 4 in the morning. And this dawn chorus rises, and David's going to get his lute and his harp out. And he's going to join in with the birds in the dawn and hope that Saul doesn't hear him and thinks that it's just the birds happen to have a new song this morning. That's what David is going to do. But more than that, he's not just going to sit in his cave and join in with the birds. That would be a wonderful thing, given his present situation. But he's going to do more than that. Look at verse 9 and 10. I will praise your Lord among the peoples. I will sing to you among the nations. Here you see, David really has got to the bottom of this promise of God. And he knows that he's going to be appointed king because God has promised it. And therefore, he's going to praise God among all the peoples. And he knows that one day he's going to stand up in front of everyone. He's not going to be stuck in a cave with a world against him. But one day, God is going to bring to pass those things that he's promised. And David even has this wonderful encouragement that he will sing to you among the nations. And David's great desire then to be able to get out of this situation, to fulfill the things that God has in store for him, and principally, therefore, to witness to what God has done. That's what's in his mind. And again, we need to bear this in mind and remember it. Even when David is in the cave, even when nothing is changed, his mind is on, one day I'll be able to witness to everybody how God rescued me from this awful situation. Why does he do all this? Verse 10 tells us, for your mercy, your steadfast love, reaches into the heavens, and your faithfulness, your truth, into the clouds. It's that same word again, your steadfast mercy, your steadfast love reaches into the heavens. So here's this theme that comes right throughout at the end of all these different sections. And David is reminding himself that God's love just gets everywhere. And you remember from earlier on that verse 5, that he was praying to be exalted, O God, among the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth. And verse 10, he's realizing, well, yes, that is true. That is exactly as it is. Your mercy does reach into all the heavens. Your truth just encompasses everywhere. So he prays exactly the same thing in verse 11 as he's prayed in verse 5. And maybe it's my imagination, but I don't think it is. I think he sings verse 11 in a far more glorious, bold way than he was able to say verse 5. So verse 5 maybe was still a prayer, a longing. We're a long way from this yet. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. But verse 11, be exalted, O God, above the heavens. That's how David finishes his psalm. Let your glory be above all the earth. And David realizes then that he's come from an impossible situation to an improving situation to an utterly impregnable situation. But nothing has changed. He's only come to realize that what God has promised will really, must, absolutely, certainly come to pass. And therefore he has nothing to fear and everything to praise.